Podcast Podcast. It's about cars, it's not about sports.
Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. That's right, it's a multi-parter. We're spooling it up. My name is Nolan Sykes, and joined with me for this series, I hope for all three parts.
Oh, this
we'll
is
find
a,
out.
This is a three-parter?
It is a three-parter.
So you got to be in here for the next 2 weeks, Jimmy. So,
oh, I'm excited.
Yeah, you're trapped.
Locked in.
Cancel all my Monday appointments.
Jimmy Hilton sitting across from me.
Hello, Nolan.
Wearing... I don't know if you guys know this. You listeners might not know this. Jimmy wears the Advan hat every single day.
It's a lucky hat.
Is that why?
Yeah.
When did it start being lucky?
Yeah, I don't know. When I decided I looked cool in it.
Oh, that's okay. All right. That's luck.
I mean, it's pretty lucky to find a hat that you feel makes you look cool every time you put it on.
And you know, it's interesting because this hat, the first time I ever saw it was in a Group A video from 1991.
No kidding.
So,
okay. Fitting.
Did you have to order that? Did you find it online somewhere?
I found it on the auction sites.
Nice.
You know.
Okay.
And I haven't found another one since. No, yeah. I love this hat.
Well, thank you so much.
Never
for
gonna
here.
Lose it.
If someone ever does draw a boardwalk style caricature of Jimmy, you must
have that hat.
It must include this hat.
You gotta do that.
Gotta have the ad.
Jimmy, can you strike a pose for the camera so they can do that? Thank you. Perfect.
Wonderful.
Very good pose.
Perfect. That other lovely, lovely voice and laugh you hear is Christina Felsky. Hello. Welcome
Hi.
Back.
Hi, Christina.
Thank you.
Hello.
I'm here.
How have you been?
I'm great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm doing great.
Hanging.
Can't complain, man.
Yeah. We're going to talk about some German Group A racing here. I am
very cool topic.
I'm very excited. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
So cool. Yas? Yas?
Da.
Da.
That's Russian. is not German.
Oh, shit.
All right. Well, now we got to go.
Well,
what
fuck.
Is yes in German?
Is it yaw?
Well, no is nine.
Yeah,
know
I
that.
Know that one.
Yes.
Yah.
Yah. Yah. Oh, shit.
Da and yah. Very
That's
close.
That's pretty embarrassing.
I want to apologize. the only German I know is ich habe in meinen Hosen gescheißen, which means I just shit my pants.
Shut
And that's because there's this movie called Stalingrad, which is about the German
great movie.
Occupation of Stalingrad. It came out in, like, I want to say the 80s or 90s.
Yeah, where all the Russians have British accents, right?
No, it's all in Russian and German.
Yeah. Oh, is this
There's a newer one that's called Stalingrad.
Okay.
This is the other one. This is an older one. And this a German soldier goes around a corner, shoots another German, like, killing his compatriot, and then says, "Ich habe in meinen Hosen gescheißen."
Oh my god!
Shit my pants.
So that stuck with me.
There has to be at least four Stalingrad movies. So I'll have to find.
I was too young
right
when
one.
I saw that movie. That was anyway. Okay, so let's shift gears here a little bit and get into some Group A racing.
Well, Mercedes-Benz has always been a bit of a more reserved luxury car company. They were often the first kids on the block when it came to racing.
Mm-hmm.
In 1902, 27 years before BMW built their first race car, Wilhelm Maybach sat down in Stuttgart and put pencil to paper to design a car the likes of which had never been seen before, the Mercedes Simplex. Up until the turn of the century, cars were pretty much just weird, one-off, horse carriage-looking creations that would pop up at fairs, belching steam and rolling coal all over the poofy-dressed aristocratic ladies.
Ooh.
But Maybach said, "Enough!"
Enough is enough.
Enough is enough. And he designed a slightly better looking horse carriage creation that didn't plaster the drivers in fuel or horse manure. And the crazy thing had a 5,315cc inline four banger that made 40 horsepower. The wagon-esque race car rolled up to the Oberforschhaus.
Gonna be a lot of that on this
Oberforschhaus circuit and wound up taking first place in the Frankfurt circuit race at the end of August that year. Then the burgeoning automotive companies started stacking up wins and even set the land speed record in 1904 with a blistering 97 miles per hour, trouncing Henry Ford's speed of 91.37 miles per hour set 5 months before on a frozen lake near Detroit.
Okay. Real quick, just for the listener.
So early.
The Simplex, like, it looks like your classic early 1900s car, like, very Model T-looking-esque, old Cadillac-esque, old jalopy is what I would say. Like, old man Jenkins and his old jalopy. Mm. He's driving something
All
like
these
this.
Damn kids.
Yeah. So, I just want to imagine you driving something like that at 97 miles an hour on basically bicycle tires.
That's
a lot.
That's sketchy.
That's sketchy. That probably feels way faster than going like 97 in any modern car right now. So now the Maybach name associated with, well, Rick Ross first.
Yeah, but second, I was going to say that.
You know, like ultra luxury cars. But not racing cars.
They got that bounce.
They do got that bounce on their air suspension. But it's interesting how that kind of shifted a little bit. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
For sure. Thank you for that.
I hope we learn about the shift in this episode. I believe we shall,
it seems.
Okay.
So it's safe to say that racing was part of Mercedes-Benz from day one. 30 years later, thanks to the backing of a guy named Adolf Hitler, Benz was diving back into land speed records with a car designed by Dr. Ferdinand Porsche and driven by Hans Stuck. The group of Nazis yanked the motor from a Messerschmitt fighter plane and tweaked it to an insane 44.5-liter inverted V12 motor that pushed 3,000 horsepower. Jesus.
Oh, wow.
That's crazy.
That's crazy. I mean, it makes sense if it's coming from a fighter plane, but that's still crazy. Then they crammed the whole thing into an almost 30-foot-long, 2.7-ton monster that was set to hit a target speed of 466 miles per hour.
Wow. Wow.
Dang.
What year were they doing this?
That's crazy.
I want to know.
Is this during the war, or is it the 30s?
It was right before the war.
Okay. Yeah.
I believe. That is where we are
trying to hit land speed records in 1944 is a little tough.
Yeah, probably. Hitler was about to do these land speed records, and then, you know, he decided to go to war. Mm-hmm, for sure.
Got it.
Well, I mean, this was all to, you know, establish the superiority of German engineering, the glory of the Third Reich and all that. I mean, that's why that was such a big deal when Jesse Owens won at the Olympics. That was kind of like a rebuttal against that, obviously. Yeah. So, I mean, they were doing the same thing here. The Nazis loved doing all sorts of these kinds of projects.
But they couldn't build an aircraft carrier.
Suck on that, Hitler, you dumb bitch. How about you learn how the ocean works? Good point, Jimmy.
Yeah, good point, Jimmy.
Couldn't do it. And obviously, they probably wouldn't have broken this land speed record either.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back after this. After World War II, and after the death of Hitler, Mercedes returned to the racetrack with the W194-300SL. Instead of a 30-foot behemoth for land speed racing, they showed up to the track with a gull-winged car that was about as long as a Honda S2000. The little racer was built around an aluminum tube frame chassis that weighed in at a shockingly light 150 pounds. That's insane. The steel frame of a C5 Corvette tips the scale at 502 pounds, while VW Bugpan weighs closer to closer to 400 pounds. That's crazy. So, I mean, obviously, though, this is in the 50s, so they're using a lot less material. They don't have as many safety considerations as something like a C5 Corvette would. So I think that skews that a little bit, but it's still very impressive. While on the winningest of winning streaks, Mercedes plunged headfirst into disaster. After the legendary Stirling Moss drove the all-new 300 SLR to a record-setting victory at the Mille Miglia, all eyes were on Team Benz at the 24 Hours of Le Mans. This is 1955. If you guys know history, you know where this is going.
We've heard this before.
We talk about this all the time.
It's a very influential event. So,
it really is.
What am I talking about here? After a Jaguar cut off an Austin Healey to get into the pit lane, Pierre Lavey, driving the new 300 SLR, smashed into the cars, and the Mercedes burst into a flaming ball, which scattered debris across the crowded stands, killing 83 spectators and leaving Lavey dead in full display on the track.
Jeez.
That's so crazy.
Official inquiries blamed no one, but Mercedes got cold feet pretty fast after the very public display of death and disaster and pulled entirely out of any sort of factory-sponsored racing. Those cold feet would continue for decades. The Mercedes factory held many employees that saw themselves as weekend racers, and most of those same employees couldn't afford to field a car with no assistance. Pulling out of factory sponsorships left those amateur racers without cars or parts. And it wasn't just Mercedes that was going through this either. I mean, like, pretty much every major manufacturer pulled out of motorsport after this. They needed to regulate themselves, basically. They didn't want government oversight telling them what they could not and could not do. So they did that voluntarily, and it spawned a lot of other cars, like the GTO over here in America. You had guys building hot rods and race cars behind the backs of executives. And I mean, that's what we're going to talk about more right
that's
now.
That's what I love to see. I work on the project after 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Is there anything else, other mentions of the 300 SL? That's like, that's a cool car.
That is a very cool car. It's,
you know, my grandpa had one.
Really?
Really?
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Brand new.
Whoa.
Sold it in the 60s for 10 grand.
Oh my shit. God. I mean, yeah, that's a lot of money back then too, though, in the 60s.
Yeah.
But
it's a cool car.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of my dream cars.
Yeah, for sure.
I think if I ever just get like, what are they, like 2-3 million?
I don't think so.
Right now?
I don't know about that. They can't be that expensive.
Are they really that expensive?
I've seen them up there.
I remember a couple years ago, this was like 2018, someone found, there's like a barn find.
Yeah, the one in Cuba.
I don't know where it was, but it was black and of course.
Oh, that one was in Florida.
Nice patina on it. And the interior was like super ratty, but it's like, that's like the ideal. For me, is finding something like that, and then you can just drive it and not worry about scratching it or anything like that. You know, make the interior nice and comfortable, but just enjoy it, and it has a lot of character, too.
Jay Leno has a red one that's kind of
I love that
banged
thing,
up, you know. It's pretty looks
cool,
like a driver.
Yeah. There's like
it
giant
looks really
chunks
cool.
of the paint gone.
Yeah.
It's very cool. Yeah,
it's a sick car.
Really
it happened, he was like, no, I will not restore this. I like it too much.
It's just that, yeah, because it has like a racing number on it, too, so it probably saw the track. It's really, really one of my favorite cars in his collection, for sure.
Wow.
All right, so.
Well, while Mercedes sat back and watched the world of racing pass them by, their faithful employees weren't quite ready to do the same. 10 years after the Le Mans disaster, Hans Werner Aufrecht, an engineer, was testing and tuning the 300 SE race engines that Benz sold but didn't use themselves, and it made him sad.
He was sitting outside the window like of the factory just like watching the race cars go by.
He had his hand to the window.
I wish that was us.
And you know what? He now haunts that factory, and there is they say on certain days you can see the handprint.
When there's just enough condensation.
When the race cars pass at the perfect point.
Yeah.
You can just barely make out his little handprint on the wall. Anyway. So he met fellow enthusiast Erhard Melker, another engineer fresh out of university, and they spent all day talking about race cars and race motors and why Mercedes should continue racing.
Sounds like a conversation around here.
It really
Everybody
does.
Always talking about cars here.
Yeah, that's true.
What are you doing with that little EF? Throwing a race engine in
crying about it. We have our project car drag race.
Oh, yeah.
Similar to our daily driver drag race video.
Mm. Yes.
And I'm trying to get my Impero ready. I went to go fire it up the other day, and what happened,
Did you fix it? A
relay underneath the dash or something like popped. So I need to replace that and get it fired up again, and then try to reset the timing on the... It's just not running very good.
Nolan's really Imperial, return of the electrical gremlin.
That's right. For real, though. Although, I think it's just that. I think it just needs to be replaced. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It'll work out. It always works out.
I feel like we're going to lose at least 5 project cars that day.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
Are you racing in it?
No. I'm kind of concerned.
The attrition is going to be high, for sure.
Like,
one trailer.
like, everyone, yeah, we should probably consider that. Be like, hey, we need
to
some
hire
backup.
Philly, have him on retainer
Stand
for that
by.
Day. Seriously, though.
For real.
It's a good idea.
We should talk about that. Yeah, because there are so many people who are like, yeah, it's running. And I'm like, you seem nervous, though.
It's fine. It'll be fine.
That's the excitement.
Well, anyway. After work, while the rest of the Benz engineers were working, Melker and Aufrecht were sneaking back to Aufrecht's basement and tinkering on the 300 SE motor because they saw some serious potential. During the day, they head to Mercedes HQ, but at night, they're helping local racers unlock the ponies and a 3-liter single overhead camshaft inline six that came stock in the 300 SE.
Okay, cool.
In 1965, one of Aufrecht's co-workers, Manfred Schaik, wanted to enter into the renowned German touring car championship.
and what's that called in German?
You know, I know it so well.
What's it called in German?
I can say it. I'm winding up.
We should all say it how we think.
Yeah, let's all say it at one time. The
Deutsche Rundstrecken Meisterschaft für Tourenwagen.
Good job. I think we did good.
Nice job, team.
Deutsche Rundstrecken Meisterschaft für Tourenwagen.
Yeah, it's good.
Great. Aufrecht and Melker hooked Shike up with the best they could do on a basement workbench. Not only did the worked over 300 SE get Shike on the track, it took him to the podium.
Hey, let's go.
Where he won first place 10 times that year.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of first place on something we didn't know would work.
That was built in a basement.
That was built in a basement.
Yeah.
That's great. You love
that
to see
that guy had
it.
His tea and biscuits, or probably not tea and biscuits, his sausages and beer probably right next to that engine.
Some sauerkraut?
Yep.
I love sauerkraut. I'm of German heritage, and I have recently rediscovered how much I love sauerkraut. Not warm, but cold out of the jar.
Never understood it.
I think it's because I buy the, like, L.A. woman version of it, because I get Bubby's. You know Bubby's, the pickle company?
Yeah, I do know Bubby's.
Yeah, Bubby's, the pickle
that's
company.
My girlfriend craves Bubby.
Yeah, not sponsored. Open to it. But, yeah, the Bubby's sauerkraut I eat out of the jar.
And
just
fellas,
standing over my sink.
And fellas, she's single.
That's true. That's the thing that I do so worry about is I'm like, how many of my things I do at my house are going to be just the weirdest when I'm not anymore?
No, it's not.
I think other people probably do that.
I've lived with partners before, but I've gotten weirder. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, no, I wouldn't worry about it. I wouldn't worry about it. I'll eat cereal out of Tupperware sometimes because I don't have a clean bowl. So I'll just get the old Tupperware out.
That's funny.
See, I always have a clean bowl. I will say that. I'll say that about me. Anyway, so the combination of numerous wins from the team and the Sutton appearance put the former Daimler duo on the map, and they became the premier engine builders that other factory teams were forced to keep an eye on as they fielded their own teams.
Keep an eye on all those guys.
These guys, Aufrecht and Melker. These guys are building up their cred on the circuit, but they were still working without support from the Mercedes mothership. Until one day in 1966, they had enough and said, "Nein!" Aufrecht and Melker ditched Daimler-Benz and went solo. The two engineers marched down to Bergstall and opened up their own shop, which they called AMG, for Aufrecht, Melker, and the town of Grossbach, where Aufrecht was born. For 5 years, the pair cashed in on their big reputations and built engines that racers begged to put in their car. Please let me put my car in there.
Give me a little engine. Just give me a little engine. Please. A little piece of it.
The Benz executives still turned their back on their prodigal sons of the track. But by this point, Aufrecht and Melker didn't need those big wigs anymore. They had their own shop with their own tools and made their own money and spent it how they wanted to.
On seafood towers.
Nice, Jimmy. But actually,
that's inside joke.
It is a bit of an inside joke. So what they want, I mean, it's a very inside
this
joke.
This is an
it's a great
extreme
one.
Inside
it's a
joke.
Great one. We got, someday it'll be all be
okay,
explained.
People,
sure. Seafood Tower. That's all you need to know. Yeah. So what they really wanted to spend their money on was not seafood towers, Jimmy, but a big red pig, specifically the late 1960s 300 SEL. This monster was as long as a giraffe was tall, a full 16 feet. And weighed in at just under 2 tons. The massive Merc sported a 6.3-liter V8 that made 247 horsepower and 369 foot-pounds of torque, which made it the fastest production four-door in not just the German market, but the entire world, which for the AMG boys seemed like the all-right place to get started.
That's as big as a great white shark.
Really?
Huh. Hmm. Some. Can be.
Could be.
Could be smaller than one, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big car.
That's a pretty big car. That's a pretty big shark.
We're going to need a bigger boat.
Nice.
Imagine that car coming at you when you're surfing. You know what I mean? Oh, boy. That's
I'd rather
and it goes
the,
oink, oink, yeah, oink.
That's almost as long as my truck.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Your truck's not that big.
It's not. I love it.
16
love
feet is big, but not also that
not
big.
Insane.
Yeah.
All right. It is big for a race car, though, and
that
that's
is
what
true.
We're going to talk about. Aufrecht and Melker rolled the giant sedan into the AMG HQ garage and got to work. They yanked the stock motor, busted out the boring machines, not boring as in uninteresting, but boring as in make this bigger, and increased the displacement of two full milk jugs worth of motor at 6.8 liters, which almost doubled the horsepower to 428.
How many jugs of Faygo is that?
So almost 3.5 liters of Faygo.
That's a lot of Faygo.
That's a lot of Faygo.
Then they started cutting sheet metal and widening axles. They flared the fenders and slapped on some aluminum doors to make the Red Pig almost look like some rich kid got lost and ended up on the racetrack with his daddy's car, but this time with rally lights. For its first big test, the Benz 300 SEL 6.8 chugged into pit lanes at the 1971 24 Hours of Spa in Belgium at Spa-Francorchamps, my favorite track to say out loud.
I didn't know it was called that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. I just thought Spa.
Spa Francorchamps.
Francorchamps.
Francorchamps. So this car was really freaking big, and it was freaking out all the other competitors who were sitting there in their tiny little race cars crafted out of pedigreed Euro ingenuity. I'm talking little MG Sprites, Austin Healey's.
They're like, this thing's too big.
Triumph TR5s, TR3s maybe at that time. Mm-hmm. Little baby cars.
There's probably an air-cooled Porsche in there.
Probably. This thing's a big old, it's a bratwurst of a car. Big.
He's a big boy. He's a thick boy.
That's right. Really thick. So,
he's a husky boy.
Very husky. Dude, when I was younger, as a child, and we were buying my jeans at Kmart. Arizona brand or Route 66. Actually, yeah, Route 66 brand. I had to get the Husky fit jeans because they didn't fit me. The normal straight cut didn't fit me. I had to get Husky.
I like that.
Because I'm at 10 years old. I got big thighs.
Yeah. Powerful thighs.
Powerful thighs.
Yeah.
You squat a house.
Strong, powerful thighs. You squatted a house?
No.
Oh.
You could probably.
Strong kid. Husky kid. So I will always back up my fellow husky kids.
I also, when I said husky, I saw in Nolan's face immediately the look of remembrance.
He basically just gazed out to sea and thought about how they came
I've
up.
Seen
with,
that
it's like
stare.
We can't call these kids fat. We can't call like they're the executives at Kmart. Like we can't call the kid like we can't call them fatty cut jeans.
What about Husky.
But also, like, just imagine.
It's kind of tough, but also, it does say, hey, this kid.
He's a little big.
He's going to be strong when he's older, but right now, he's self-conscious.
All right, put it down, Husky.
What do you think they'd call it now? I do think they would say
now.
Oh, thick,
what would they call
thick,
it now?
Thick two Qs.
Honestly, well, now they call it athletic, actually.
Oh.
I think athletic
really?
Cut because, yeah, you got big thighs. You've been in the gym. But, you know, you're at A&F, Abercrombie.
Oh, yeah.
You're getting athletic cut, and you're like, man, I'm not really athletic.
Oh, you don't got to tell me.
I haven't gone to the gym in like a year.
What do you mean?
I'm out of, you know, if I go above 5,000 feet, I'm elevation. I'm searching for air anywhere I go, man. I'm not athletic. What are we doing?
I can't breathe.
I can't breathe. Just call me Husky again.
It's time to keep the lights on, so we'll be right back after this message.
So the big Husky Red Pig started 5 positions back and quickly made it to the front of the pack, where it remained for the entire 24 hours. The beefy Benz bullied its way through the crowd and wound up blowing away the competition and taking top place in the cars class, as well as second in the race overall against cars that were custom designed
That's
to win that
crazy.
Exact race and drivers who had been running that track for a decade. That's insane. Alfrecht and Melker thought perhaps it could have stolen the checkered flag if the big thirsty pig didn't have to keep stopping for gas.
Story of my life. I don't know. Open to interpretation. I love this car.
Yeah.
We've talked
this
about it so
cool.
Ad nauseum at this
yeah,
point.
Again,
yeah.
We've talked about it almost too much. I hope you guys are enjoying yet another iteration of this, but this car is so sick. Like, I just, I love this car.
100%.
If you haven't seen a picture of it,
It'll be right here.
Yeah,
and if you haven't heard the did we do like a 4-part series on Mercedes?
It was like so many.
It was long, but if you want to know more about this car, check out that series.
Yeah, we talked about it for a while.
Go more into detail on it.
Is this thing in Germany still? It's still probably at the AMG Museum.
Either there or somewhere in Miami. All right.
Why
so,
Miami?
Because The Rock lives there. No, I don't know.
Because everyone's so rich.
No.
So in that 24-hour time span, AMG sealed its fate and secured a place in the heart of not only Mercedes enthusiasts, but also the suit and tie brigade that ran Mercedes.
All right. Ooh, it's called the Red Pig and it won?
It's won. It's a one. As the early 70s became the 70s car enthusiasts know and hate, Mercedes wasn't spared the gas crisis. Racing was pretty boring on both sides of the pond for people who were into production car racing. While Europeans were definitely putting out cars that were light years ahead of Chevettes and Yugos, they're still kind of blah.
Eh.
Blah. Towards the end of the 70s, Benz was rally racing their V8 coupes.
Nice.
The factory whipped up a few cars for the Vuelta a la America del Sur. A 30-day, 4,350-mile-long, grueling race that winded from Buenos Aires to Rio, Bogota, Lima, and other cities in other countries.
We need more races like that.
I agree with you on that.
I love that kind of style.
I love just treating another country's roads like my own personal playground.
They get tourism out of it.
I love expecting a country's populace to just...
Get out of the way.
It is funny. The more like podcasts we've done and the more videos we've made, I'm like, it's kind of messed up sometimes. Some of these races are kind of messed up.
I mean, we could go down this rabbit hole if we wanted, but let's just bob around in the ocean of, you know.
Let's do it. Okay.
Acceptance. So. The V8 Mercedes squeaked out a win by just 20 minutes. That's
nuts. Actually really close.
Yeah, that is really close for rally. At the Rally Bandama, a race which only 1 out of 10 entrants finished due to its insanely difficult conditions, the Mercedes 450 SLC won the top 4 spots out of only 8 that finished in a field of 68.
Oh, okay, so this is the Ivory Coast Rally.
This is cool.
So they still do this.
Oh.
Nice.
That's cool. But as smaller, more nimble cars emerged with their spinny boys, the big V8 guys fell out of fashion. By the early 1980s, Mercedes looked to the 190E and wanted to trick it out for rally racing. So they consulted Cosworth to tease 320 horsepower out of the existing 136 horsepower four-cylinder motor so they could better compete on the rally courses. Good job, Cosworth.
That's a name I know.
That is a name I also know. But while Cosworth was wrenching out the horsepower from the 190E, Audi dropped a bomb on the rally circuit in the form of the Quattro, which outclassed all of Mercedes' offerings with its four-wheel drive and 300 horsepower inline five-cylinder.
Well, yeah, I mean, kind of underselling it there. I mean, Quattro, this all-wheel drive, I mean, this completely changed the game in terms of rally. It's just... more grip, more traction, better control over your car. Audi came in and completely wiped the field with this new system, this new technology. And, I did not realize that rally would become a big part of Group A here. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a reason it's called Group B.
Yeah. The 190E didn't stand a chance against their fellow German car makers on the rally circuit. So, they took the little Mercedes that could over to the Deutsche Tourenwagen Meisterschaft, or DTM, in 1985. Deutsche Tourenwagen Meisterschaft, DTM. While a Volvo 240 turbo brick took the checkered flag that year, the 190E 2.3 16 God's feet wet and got a feel for the track as the production numbers brought the car into homologation. To comply with homologation rules, Mercedes-Benz released the 190E 2.3 16 Cosworth. The four-cylinder motor was based on the less-than-exciting 136-horsepower 2.3 motor, but Cosworth managed to saddle up a full 182 horsepower and 173 foot-pounds of torque out of the engine through enlarging the intake and exhaust ports, slapping on an ultra-lightweight alloy head and pistons, and the very clever Bosch K Jetronic fuel injection system. After ditching tons of weight and balancing out the bounce with McPherson struts and anti-roll bars, the 2,900-pound car would reach 0-60 in a respectable, for the time, 7.2 seconds. While factories were required to produce 5,000 of these cars to pass regulation, Mercedes went all out and rolled more than 14,000 190Es off the factory floor in the span of 2 years. That's pretty sick. Back at the DTM circuit in 1986, the car's first year saw two big wins, and Helmut Marko from Team AMG taking runner-up for the whole championship, even though he started the season 3 races late.
Oh, Helmut Marko.
Wow. Okay.
Dang him.
Dang, Helmut Marko.
At the ADAC Eifelrennen Volkswagen. What the?
Let's say it all at once.
At ADAC
Eifelrennen Volkswagen
bested the V8 Rover Vitesse by a single second and the BMW 325i by more than 40 seconds. More teams picked up the 190e Cosworth as a racing platform and drove them to top 10 finishes with confidence. This thing was a weapon. The Bavarians, though, watching the little Merc, were not happy. They witnessed their 325s and 635s get trounced by Volvos and the Cosworth-powered Benz, and they saw Imola red. That's a little BM joke for you. That's a little BMW joke for you. BMW wanted some dubs of their own, and they wanted to do it with the E30. But as it stood, the car just wasn't up to the task. So they stripped the car down and started from zero to build the M3 with the help of M. M was BMW's motorsport division. They were formed to, quote, bring the speed to dealerships and let the average Joe get behind the wheel of a true performance car. And that's exactly what AMG called down on themselves with the 190e. They just kicked off the biggest grudge match in German racing history, and they were absolutely not prepared for what would happen when the M3 hit the track for the first time.
They kicked the hornet's nest. This is going to be
a hornet's nest.
This is the intro episode.
That's a lot
this
of is, angry
This
hornets.
Is the prologue right here.
I am very excited for the next episode.
Because I'm glad.
This is like the peak racing
this is it.
Like of European sports
That's
cars.
Right.
This is sweet.
And we're not over yet. In 2019, Mercedes-Benz made a commercial thanking BMW for 100 years of competition and rivalry. While the two manufacturers have totally different philosophies, and Mercedes almost bought BMW in 1959, they've managed to stay at each other's throats for a solid century. Without the 190e Cosworth ripping up DTM, there would be no M-Class BMWs. But going back to 1970, the BMW Alpina 2800 destroyed the entire field at the 24 Hours of Spa, which helped inspire Alfrecht and Melker create AMG to roll up in their 300 SEL in the first place.
Mm.
It doesn't matter if the chicken or the egg came first. What matters is these two manufacturers going head-to-head, leading to the birth of some of the most iconic cars of all time, and they kept getting better. As BMW tweaked their M3, Mercedes kept releasing new evolutions of the 190e. These cars got faster and faster, and the people who benefited, aside from the car makers racking in dump trucks and money, were the normal drivers who got to see it trickle down into their local car dealerships. The Group A rivalry between BMW and Mercedes led to a swath of high-performance street cars that fueled games like Gran Turismo and Forza and created what is still referred to as the golden era of production car racing, as Jimmy mentioned, the late 80s to the late 1990s. And that's what we're going to talk about next week, the birth of the M3 and beyond.
Woo!
I'm excited.
Woo.
We
did it.
That's going to be so sick.
Yeah.
I mean...
Good. It was a good refresher.
A good refresher.
I think that's the thing is like, it's hard to do an automotive history podcast where you don't talk about some of the same stuff. Like,
that's true.
You know,
There's
the red pig
setup.
And
yeah.
also Hitler a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Other fascists, yeah. You know.
We've got some fan mail this week. I'm Evan, and I've been watching Donut since I was around 10.
Aw.
You guys have made a huge impact on my interests and hobbies as I was growing up. I've seen just about every high, low, and up to speed there is, and I've been using Passgas as my dedicated lawn mowing podcast since Ford vs. Ferrari. I love that,
dude. That's so solid.
I wish podcasts existed when I was 10 because I didn't even have an iPod when I was 10. But I know what you mean about mowing lawns, dude.
I wish I had a lawn to mow.
I also we live in California.
It actually
that's
sucks.
Not drought safe.
It kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Mowing lawns. Anyway. I'm writing to you today because I recently got my first car, a 2004 Mustang.
Nice.
Because of watching people like you guys, I've been able to start wrenching on the car semi-independently.
Aww.
If it weren't for Donut, I probably wouldn't be interested in driving yet. Wow. Let's
How go, old are dude. You?
So probably
Evan?
16 or 17.
Okay.
Probably. Thank you so much for the impact you've had on me as a person. The entire squad has been a part of making me who I am today. Sorry if I'm not exactly the target demographic here. But I managed to slip through the cracks, and it was probably one of the best things that I could have asked for. Evan, much love from Idaho. Well, thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
For your letter, and I'm glad that we could kind of nudge you in that direction a little bit.
Also, Evan, you're the exact target demographic.
Yeah.
You're the exact demographic,
once
Evan.
Once he turns 18 to 34 years old,
yes.
That's the real, true demographic there. No, but yeah, man. Have fun with that Mustang. Honestly, dude, you have any questions about how to work on that thing? Chris Fix, he's got you covered.
Yeah.
What? He's good at that.
He's got the same Mustang, too.
Yeah, he's got that same generation Mustang. So, no, but that's really cool, man. And keep mowing those lawns, dude. I hated doing that. Hated doing that. Until I got my iPod, then it was tolerable, but I hated mowing my lawn. It sucked. Mostly crabgrass. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to Pass Gas this week. Follow Jimmy at russelledjimmy.jp on Instagram. Follow Christina at Christina Felsky.
That's true.
Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes if you'd like. If you'd please, I don't know. I've been seeing my followers been going up lately. It's nice. Interesting.
That's great.
Yeah, thanks to our crew, Gavin Kinzel, Nick Giamuso. We'll see you next week with part two of DTM Group A. Let's go.
I'm excited.
Pew!